Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning. Wow, it is actually a good morning.
It is. It's
the light is bright.
Something like that.
I saw some ball of fire in the sky.
Are you hallucinating again?
I can't tell. How would I know? How would I know if it was a hallucination?
You're drinking your urine moonshine again?
How could I possibly know? Hey, you're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM on your dial here in Portland, Oregon. And this is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show.
How do you know if you're hallucinating? Well, you compare what you're seeing with your roadmap of reality that you carry around in your head.
What roadmap of reality?
Well, you should have something like
reality
that.
Reality is a social construction,
you look at
dude.
What you're perceiving, and you measure that against what you know to be real, and if there's a discrepancy, you might conclude that you're hallucinating.
You have a totalitarian view of reality.
Yes. Well, I maintain that reality has a liberal bias, and we're going to get into that a little bit today.
Oh, my goodness. All right. This is Abe Proctor over there. I'm Joe Uris, and he's crazy. 231-8187.
That's right. This is Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show. You can also listen on the internet tubes, www.kboo.fm. Today, we're going to talk about the two competing budget proposals in Washington. And whether or not we have, as I've maintained in the past, actually seen the end of liberalism as a governing philosophy in this country, or whether it might still be limping along.
Wait a minute. I don't think liberalism was ever really a governing philosophy.
Oh, it was for several decades following the Second World War.
No.
All right. Well, we can talk about that,
too. Yeah, we'll have to talk about that.
All right. You want to follow up on last week's show?
I do. I want to just make one short comment, and this is an interesting thing, and I think people ought to be calling the media about it. One of the ways in which the working movements, working class movements, the unions, the peace movement, the movements for social change and social improvement, et cetera, make their opinions known traditionally, going way back, is, of course, to parade, to march, to have demonstrations, to sit in, to do whatever of that sort that isn't, that isn't structured around commercial advertising. This is important. It is. It functions in two ways. It functions to unify the forces that are struggling to make the change, and it's not necessarily left or right, by the way. But it's struggling to create its sense of purpose and its direction and its goals and its holistic aspects. The other aspect, of course, is that it's trying to influence public opinion by the demonstrations it carries out. Everybody knows. Okay, it's all clear. But I noticed that the Tea Party demonstration, which was tiny on Friday because it was raining, I guess, and Tea Partiers are fair weather fighters. I noticed
it dilutes your tea.
What?
The rain.
Yeah, it dilutes your tea.
Dilutes
right.
Your tea.
Thank you. And I noticed that they didn't get really any coverage, and I thought, okay, well, And then this very large march, about 3,000 people of organized labor people and peace activists and socially concerned individuals, vaguely of liberal left persuasion, that took place on Saturday with a big rally and a march and then another rally. That event had no coverage from, as far as I know, from any of the networks. Any of the local stations, any of the newspapers, well, the newspaper, they all didn't pay attention. And it was, I think, a shutout, a deliberate kind of shutout. The only time recently the demonstrations gotten attention is when some black bloc people got into a fight. Actually, the police got into a fight with the black bloc people. So it seems to me that unless laws are broken or police people attack, these demonstrations are ignored. And this is fundamentally very unfortunate and very unfair, and it kind of creates a sense of desperation and rage. And it's a mistake, and it's bad, and I wonder what's going on.
It's nothing new.
Well, no. I mean, it's nothing new in the sense that usually the coverage is poor or undercovered, but this is no coverage.
Hmm.
It's a new thing, I think. And it used to be that the television stations would cover because it's colorful.
Right, especially if there's some violence.
Well, or even if there's, the drum corps or whatever. And now it's a shutout.
Hmm.
And I'm just beginning to wonder, is this a pattern? I know that the news stations are understaffed. I know the Oregonian is virtually non-staffed. And I understand that it's cheaper to have people sit by a phone and wait for stories to be handed to them by PR people. And I'm getting a little concerned about this, because the function of the press, the only validity for the press, as far as I'm concerned, is that it does report the news. And this is clearly a case of it's not.
Well, certainly there's other things that give validity to the press, right?
What?
Well, if you've gone through the check stand of Fred Meyer, how else are you going to know which celebrity is divorcing whom or
Good
having
point.
An affair with somebody else?
It's very, you're right there.
Okay.
Who got shot?
That's right.
You know.
That's very important. Who's on a diet?
Right.
Who's got a nice bikini body for the summer season?
That's your problem.
Well, my bikini body is solid, man.
Oh, yeah. Okay. People don't
That's
know
right.
that this is, you know, it's radio. That works.
503-231-8187. Should we move on to the business at hand?
I think we better.
Okay. Last week, the president gave a speech about the budget negotiations in Washington. I use the term negotiations loosely.
Yeah, really.
We'll explain that here in a little while. But he did another one of those great Obama things. He gave a very vigorous defense of progressivism and made a pretty good case for liberalism as a governing philosophy. Now,
well, yes,
you contradicted me earlier in the show when I mentioned that.
I don't think so. I think it was a weak speech, actually.
You thought it was a weak speech?
Yeah, and I think that he didn't. First of all, he avoided all the traditions that characterize a sense of the righteous necessity for liberal democracy.
Such as?
Well, he didn't talk about the tradition of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. He didn't talk about the tradition of Lyndon Johnson. He didn't talk about the role of the Democratic Party, even implicitly, in all of this. He created a, we can all sit together and do a kumbaya thing.
Right. Well, see, that's what he does. You're right. He should have made explicit
well,
reference to
Well, the hell with kumbaya.
It's a nice song.
Well, sure. Okay. Somebody's praying.
You're right. He should have explicitly mentioned those things. He's needed to do that for a long time because that would ground what seems to guide his philosophy in actual history, which is an important step.
What philosophy?
The one that says there's a reason that we have government and there's a reason that we pay into government, especially the wealthy, and there's a reason that we collectively invest in the social support system, such as it is.
Yeah. I had, like many people, I had been swept up in the enthusiasm for Obama for reasons that maybe even would be called racist. That is, I thought, how neat, an African-American president of the United States. This is symbolically significant. This is culturally significant.
I don't think that makes you racist.
His speeches, and I went down and I was with the 70 zillion people at the waterfront with my little press pass, and I got close and I looked at the guy and I was impressed, and I thought, this is very cool. And from the moment he started operating as president of the United States, I was struck by what I have to call a very serious weakness in the way in which he was structuring his government, who he was bringing into positions of power, how he was handling crises, the kind of language he was actually using, the metaphors that he understood. I now believe sincerely that he may or may not have a real liberal or left perspective. I doubt the left part for sure. But what he really is the guy who tries to find the middle to bring the parties together, regardless.
Okay.
Of the right or wrongness of the parties involved.
Agreed. I think fundamentally in his political character, he's more of a mediator than he is an executive. He's a pretty long shot from a bare-knuckled guy like Lyndon Johnson, for example.
Well, there's another reason here, too, which is important, which is experience. Lyndon Johnson had the dirt on everybody, and he'd been in Congress for a long, long time, and he fought these fights all the way up through. He, of course, also was very foolish about American imperialism and the Vietnam War and so on, but he knew whose arm to twist, whose back to pat. He understood the process of getting things done in Congress. Obama really had no, and this is not his fault, but it's true, he had no real experience as a senator. He came up very suddenly out of the Chicago kind of politics, and he didn't have the necessary clout with Congress that is so important to getting things done, particularly when the things you want to get done are things that have an inherent resistance among the very basically conservative members of Congress.
Yeah, I would agree with those points. Again, what I'm seeing here is a pattern. Obama gave this speech last week in which he articulated a liberal governing philosophy, explained why we need these institutions, why it's irresponsible and even cowardly to propose doing away with them, as the Republicans have done.
Mm-hmm.
But he also, while he hit these points in the larger sense, the details were full of signals that he's willing to concede on a whole range of points. He said everything, every spending option is on the table. And I have to read that as including such things as Social Security, as Medicare, as Medicaid, and on and on and on. this is troubling to me because we've seen this sort of thing before in the battle before the health care legislation. He came out and gave a series of speeches articulating why it's important to allow people to opt into Medicare, the so-called public option. Mm-hmm. When it came time to do away with the Bush tax cuts on the wealthy elite, he made a good point as to why they need to pay more in taxes. But in all of these cases, he ended up capitulating. When push has come to shove, every single time when Obama has bumped up against the prerogatives of his donor class, he has backed down every single time. And I'm afraid this is just going to happen again.
Well, I'm afraid you're right. And I think what it is, I mean, the analogy somebody said is he always punts on the first down. I mean, he doesn't like a bare knuckles brawl.
No, he doesn't. And I think he understands the principle of mediation more than he does the principle of negotiation. He's good at standing.
Hey, that was good.
Thanks. He's good at standing between two opposing sides and finding some place where both sides can stand and agree. But he's not good at representing one of those sides and coming out swinging to negotiate a good position for himself. Krugman last week put it as he seems to have a preliminary round of negotiations with himself. Then he comes out with a preliminary round of concessions, and then he goes to the table. So as Krugman also noted about this speech last week, Paul Krugman. Nobel Prize winning economist, columnist for the New York Times. Krugman noted that Obama's position, as articulated in his budget speech, that makes a fine place for us to end up. But if that's the leftward goalpost, as it were, from which we start, and we're going to move right from here, then we're in trouble. And all signs point to that being exactly the case.
You know, I think we should let people call us.
I think we should. 503-231-8187. We're also taking emails, joeandabe@yahoo.com. Thomas, you're up first.
Hey, good morning, fellas. Comments about the budget, but just briefly, as far as the big labor rally that happened on Saturday, Joe, you were saying that the media didn't show up. Surprise, surprise. I've been doing this for the last 20 years, and the media usually doesn't show up. There were few 300,000-400,000 person marches in San Francisco, anti-war marches that the media barely showed up to, and almost no national coverage. And state capital in Sacramento and California, tens of thousands of people. So this is nothing new. I think we just have to look at such a rally, such organized marches, as being sort of a pep rally for people to meet each other and become empowered, and not as anything that the politicians are going to look at and changing. As long as we don't have that expectation that we can go home and we can go and have a rally, and then that's going to be our political action. As far as the budget, it's interesting. The reason and justice are sort of off the table in the whole discussion. And to be honest, the budgets that are being proposed are they betray a value structure, I think, which would shame a nation of savages. And it just goes to show the absolute ethical and bankruptcy and intellectual poverty of both the dominant political parties. And as far as I can't remember if it was Abe or Joe, which one of you said about the two competing budgets. Well, I would say that's a false alternative. We have the Progressive Caucus, the largest caucus in Congress. What about their budget? That's totally different.
It is. You're right. But I guarantee you that's not going to be the budget that's ultimately voted on.
It's going to be just as invisible as the workers' rallies and the peace rallies, and you can bet it's not going to be talked about. I think as far as the budget, the best thing to do to look at it, to understand it, is not to look so much about what the difference in the two, main promoted budgets are, but what has broad bipartisan support in the budgets, and so far, what are the sacrosanct elements that nobody will talk about or nobody will touch. You have the weapons and war expenditures, multi-billion-dollar subsidies to coal, nuclear, oil mining, and big agriculture. The big, massive tax handout to the top 5% of wealthy in the country. The offshore banking and tax cheats. So you have this incredible, this giant body of massive amounts of government expenditure, which are not even being touched by either party. As far as this thing with the Obama administration, I have to disagree with the narrative talking about the limitations of Obama and the fact that he's a mediator. Obama, I would submit, is really a salesman. And we have to look at the fact that that, you know, you say, well, he's a compromiser. Well, the thing is that implies that there's a set of intentions to do otherwise in the first place, and I don't think that there's an evidentiary body to suggest that. You know, and as far as this tough talk down, now that Obama signed off without a fight on the big tax cut for the wealthy and most of these odious elements of this budget that's being promoted, you know, Obama's essentially just playing to the base now and running his mouth for the next electoral cycle and saying, well, in 2012 we're going to get tax cuts. In 2012, just kicking the can further down, you know, down the road. No, and look, right, and we have these essentially these, you know, this entire retinue of neoliberal mandarins and corporate toadies that are in the top positions, and those are the people that really, you know, that are forming this policy. And let me translate something for people. You know, you heard it's not politically possible. You know, well, we'd love to do that, but it's not politically possible. Let me give you the translation of that. The direct translation of that is my big corporate campaign donors don't really want right. me to do that in the first place, and I know exactly where my money comes from. And that's the way it's going to go. And as far as the budget, you know, really, you're talking about just a continuation. This is the second new Democrat in office in the last 30 years. You're going to see the wholesale privatization spree continue, NAFTA style, you know, labor crushing trade pacts continue. This sixth systematic dismantlement of the welfare state, and we, you know, and that's what the budget shows. There's only so many ways you can put the lipstick on the pig and call it a compromise or say whatever it is, but in reality, it's a wholesale dismantlement.
I think you're right, unfortunately. I think there's another aspect to this, and that aspect is that whatever the reasons, the vaguely liberal, possibly with a few names, left-wing element that could be dominant, that should be dominant, particularly in the Senate, the pre-compromisers, lack the will to power. And the characteristic that is most significant of the right at this time is an Ayn Rand philosophy with a very strong neo-fascist will to power. And in politics, that can be a crucial element. That is what produces the sense of omniscience and the sense of empowerment that can drive politics way, way, way to the right. And that's what's happening right now.
I think you're right. And listen, thank you very much for the call, Thomas. I'm glad you mentioned that, Joe. When I was doing the research for the show, I came across an opinion piece at WashingtonPost.com by Sally Cohn, in which she posits the innate tendency of liberals and progressives to be tolerant and open-minded is a political handicap. Our tolerance can lead us to a position of political weakness in the face of the will to power that you're just discussing. I'm going to quote from Cohn's piece right now. This is the essence of what Obama, the community organizer, came to Washington to do, not to push an agenda, but to change the culture of the Capitol to be more inclusive, open-minded, civil, and democratic. Unfortunately, there are no points for playing nice. And she's absolutely correct.
It's not a system built around that concept at all, and never will be.
No, not at all.
It's vote counting.
Exactly. The federal system set up by the framers, you'd learned about separation of powers back in elementary school. Why? Because that takes the will to power that you talked about and fragments it and divides that power up amongst many people so that no one person or group of people can consolidate too much power in any one set of hands. That is the genius of democratic systems around the world.
Except the assumption of the founding fathers that their ruling class would rule.
Perhaps,
always.
Yes.
No,
but,
really.
But within this framework, it becomes okay for people to express the will to power because the system itself mitigates the harmful effects.
Let's go to the phones. You're right. I'm not arguing with you.
Jeff, you're next.
Hi, Jeff. Jack.
Yeah. Hey, did you guys forget that our country is founded upon the rights of landowners rather than the rights of laborers?
Well, I think you made a good point. I was alluding to that earlier.
Well, good for you. Now, why do you keep ignoring that?
How are we ignoring it?
What do you mean?
We're not talking about it. You're not sharing your feelings about it. You're not chatting about it.
We opened the show talking about labor. We spent all of last week's show talking about labor.
No, talking about the rights of landowners, I said.
I guess from my point of view, I take it as a given that landowners have rights, and I don't see much tendency to change that. Are you arguing that landowners are being stripped of their rights? Is that where you're going?
Not stripped, just impinged.
Just what? I'm sorry.
Impinged of their rights.
Oh, I see. Well,
now, I've got another question. Let's move on here.
Oh, okay. Let's move on.
You've been talking about how Obama has been a disappointment to his peers and his supporters.
Yes.
Were you listening to his campaign speeches where he described himself as a mediator, as a nice guy, and as some sort of an organizer?
Oh, yeah, I heard all those speeches. Sure.
He described himself that way when he was campaigning, yet you voted for him?
Yeah, sure.
So your point is that we were just naive and silly?
Well, why are you reiterating and trying to report on something that is already commonly known?
Okay.
Do you have an answer to that question?
What was the question?
Why are you spending so much time this morning bemoaning what is already common knowledge about Obama?
Probably because both of us are concerned about the state of the discourse in Washington and about the future for the Republic. Obama's the president, thus we talk about him.
Well, you see, those concerns should be dealt with at the onset. That is while he's being considered for office, rather than
That cow left the barn, man.
That cow left the barn.
That cow left the barn. Yes.
No, it's still in the barn because Obama's still in the White House.
All right, farmyard metaphors aside, what's your point?
I've got a question for you, Abe.
Okay.
This morning, as you share your feelings, your fears, your misgivings, your impressions.
Yes.
Do your personal feelings really bear upon any issues here?
Sure. I think sure that's enough of that, because it's sort of like a personal attack.
Certainly do. All of us as citizens of this republic evaluate the situation both intellectually and emotionally. Many of us have feelings about how things are going,
feelings.
And it's appropriate to bring those into the discussion. I'm not sure what the thrust of that question was.
A Barbara Streisand-ish
person.
Well,
I'm sure he is, and he's not the only one out there making similar sorts of insinuations.
I think it was kind of hostile.
I feel that guy's kind of a jerk.
We just say they're hostile. Politically correct.
I feel that he was being contemptuous towards us. I feel like
let's
it's time for another phone
231-8187.
Call.
231-8187. Mitchell, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Yeah, good morning.
You're not going to beat us up, are you?
No, I don't think so. it's an interesting topic, but you give Barry Satoro, by calling him President Obama, a title and everything. But you were talking about taxes. And
that is his title. He is the president.
Well, he's there. He's a teleprompting.
No, he ran for president, and he won, and that's his title.
Right, he won. I can't deny that.
Okay.
But he's not what everyone says. Anyway, with the taxes and everything, here's the thing. You want to rally somewhere, look what they're doing overseas. They're making some of us ashamed to call ourselves patriots, okay? When they rally, they have meaning. They want their freedom and democracy back. Our freedom and democracy has been hijacked by this illegitimate government that has more corporate interests than human interests.
Well, I don't think it's illegitimate, and that's part of the problem structurally. What we're talking about is a system which certainly has been in existence for a long, long time that legitimizes power in the hands of the powerful. And the question always underneath all of our conversation is how do we, within that structure of government, which does have elements of democracy, how do we grasp the wheels of power? The last big crisis was the Great Depression. And in the Great Depression, great change took place. We're in a similar economic crisis, but this time no great change is taking place. And that's really the essence of my point of view.
Well, great change has taken place. We were America the free. Now we're America the hostage.
Hostage to?
To wars.
Oh, and I see what you're saying.
Supporting this military-industrial complex that calls itself democracy.
Well, I think your point's right, in a way, but I think also that...
you've got to go deep. These guys aren't playing games with the American people. They've done sold us out, and these little one-day rallies ain't going to do it. We got to get together and tell everyone we know that we have to be patriotic and take our government back, You remember when Rome fell, they sent their armies to the furthest outposts, okay? They robbed the people blind. That's what's happening to America. Just study history.
Okay, man.
Thank you.
Hey, thank you for the call.
231-8187.
I was just about to say that.
Oh, we were stepping
over
each other.
Read my mind.
Incompetent.
you can also send us an email, joeandabe@yahoo.com. Bill, good morning.
We need a president who is a lot more than just an affirmative action project, because that's about all we have. Thanks.
Okay, thank you for that.
Well,
503-231-8187.
Hey, you know, we're not hearing from women.
Affirmative action project.
Speaking of
that's
affirmative
action,
that's a nonsensical
statement on so many levels.
Okay,
I think that's all I'm going to say about it.
All right, let's go to Mark.
Mark.
Yes, I feel like one of the main answers to our problems is we need an American Labor Party. We have to strengthen third and fourth parties. We've got a couple of those out there, but I really feel this country needs a Labor Party by and for the American worker.
I think you're right, but here's the problem. We have a structure that has evolved over a long period of time in which it's very, very rare for third parties to get a foothold. The last time that happened in any real significance, even including the Progressive Era and the Bull Moose Party and so on, but the last time it happened with any real significance was the creation of the Republican Party back in the 1850s. So there is
We had Perot, and that was kind of a party. Unfortunately, there was an amazing movement behind Perot. Unfortunately, Perot turned out to be somewhat of a flake, and that whole movement dissipated.
It was more a cult of personality than a political party.
Yeah, and when you got down to his analysis, it was, let's open the hood and look at the motor. I don't think that's much of an analysis of the situation. It's a nice analogy, but nothing more.
Despite the difficulties, I feel that is really the only way to go. We have to get rid of the power of these two Democratic and Republican parties.
Well, you're not alone. A lot of people.
They're identical, and they are they're destructive.
I think a lot of people would agree with you, and I'm sure we'll have many calls supporting your position. Thanks a lot for the call, man.
I don't think that's quite right.
You know,
I don't think the problem is that we have two parties or that they're called what they are. The problem is that both of them are beholden to their donors. We need to break the power of the donor class.
But you just had a Supreme Court decision that says the donor class can do whatever it wants.
I realize that.
And you don't even have to tell who's doing it.
Yeah, I know. I'm not saying
it'll
be
easy. That's the end of the game, man.
Yeah, it very well may be the end of the game. We got an email. Ansel writes to say, I agree that the government is running out of money, but it is not because of spending on needed programs and services. The main reason is because the tax rate on the upper income brackets has dropped by half since the 1990s. It's also dropped by about fivefold since the 1930s and 40s and 50s.
Well, yeah, and in fact, our greatest level of prosperity for average Americans was in the 50s, when organized labor was fairly strong. Its highest membership was in 55, and when the tax rate for the rich was at its highest,
above 90%. That's right. Continuing. We can't afford good schools for workers' children because the rich are no longer part of the social compact that created our nation. Workers provided the wealth that the rich have accumulated when manufacturing was part of the American economy. Now that manufacturing has fled to cheaper overseas labor sources, the rich have abandoned American workers whom they no longer need. I think that's entirely accurate.
I think Ansel's got the right line there.
503-231-8187. Who's next? Michael.
Hello. Good morning.
Good morning.
Always a good show.
Thank you.
Get things going. Actually, I've been trying to get on your show since Joe came back, and several discussions have been...
Don't waste time with that. Get to it.
Oh, God. it seems to me that this whole series of shows you guys had with call us if you have any solutions to the problem was something that I've been trying to say. It seems as though we have rallies, we show up, the press doesn't. I think the main reason the press doesn't show up is because if other people saw what was possibly working, more people would come out, and that would be a problem.
It's the threat of a good example, as Charles
Well, I sort of agree with you, but I have to add this. The press is underpaid now, and it's understaffed, and it's very lazy.
And we have a problem in that We want change. We want things to change. And then we vote for someone, and somewhere most of us knew that this was just a lesser of two evils once again.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me, I voted for Nader. It seems to me, I knew that Obama was going to win before I did that.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, I would have voted for him, which takes me to my point. What we need to do is have a generational decision for something that we're going to push for. We need to install instant runoff elections nationally. This is something...
Well, that's a good idea.
That is a good idea.
I can go up and down my... I challenge everyone who's listening, and you, to come up with one thing that this would not affect, that this would not actually push forward. This is the same model that Acorn was beginning to introduce, which, of course, probably was their demise. And at the same time that the Working Party began to come up, Working People's Party began to come up, it was when the Tea Party began to get notice.
Mm-hmm.
That is sort of the corporate response to a natural voting program like instant runoff elections. It works quite well in Ireland. It works quite well in many other nations. And it would sway people. If 2/3 of the Democratic Party or 1/3 of them voted for Kucinich, and that would send a powerful message to someone who wants to stay in the main line or in the middle of the road.
No, I think your suggestion is very good. I just wanted to, for folks out there may not know, the Working People Party, which I think is a great party, is looking for such reforms as this. And in fact, opening the ballot so that you could vote for, let's say, Obama on the Working People Party line on the ballot. And there are ways, and that's, by the way, a pattern that exists in New York State, has forever. There are ways to make it more democratic without changing the Constitution. And I think your point is a kind of a good one.
Hey, caller, can you explain instant runoff voting very quickly for our listeners?
It's simply, it would be, let's use the Kucinich thing as an example.
Mm-hmm.
Or Ralph Nader, it would be perfect. The second election, when everyone was afraid that if we voted because of the way the news twisted that, which wasn't the truth, but that everyone was afraid to vote for Ralph Nader again because, oh, if we do that, then Bush will win, or worship that crazy woman from Alaska. So you would have two choices. You would have a choice to vote for Ralph Nader, and then to avoid it being a spoiler, if that was not enough to get him into the runoff, then your vote, your second choice vote, would go to, let's say, Obama.
I see.
That way, what you're doing is you're pulling. You're allowing people to say, well, I want to send a message. I really want this person to win. But I'm afraid that if I vote for him, my vote's going to get wasted, and then this person I really don't want to win is going to win, you know, like Bush or something.
Right, so you say, I really like person X, but I'd be willing to settle for person Y as long as that keeps person Z from actually winning.
The problem with I like that idea. Well, there's one problem with it. If you remember, I don't know if people pay attention, but the last presidential election in France before the one that put Sarkozy in power forced everybody to avoid Le Pen, the racist right-wing guy, from winning. It forced everybody to vote for the conservative guy. And that's always a danger in these kinds of structures. But I agree with you. I think that some kind of instant runoff process would make more sense than what we're doing now.
Well, I challenge anyone to come up with any idea that you're talking about that this would not affect.
Well, I like
the wages, the firing of employees.
I agree.
You vote for Kucinich, who's saying that that's ridiculous. You have a second choice, and you know, as far as Obama goes, I don't understand why he's not being held account to all the things that he said, including Amy Goodman's repeating on the news just twice anyway his senatorial comments about how he would stand up there and lead the marches if they tried to take these
worker rights away.
Exactly.
Yeah, look, I'm not
you
here.
You caught me before my coffee this morning. So.
Sorry.
You're doing well.
You're doing fine, but I agree that it is very disappointing that people don't hold Obama's feet to the fire. And I think one of the things I like about Amy Goodman and others, including Krugman, is that they're screaming in both agony and outrage at the lack of strength, moral strength, moral fiber, guts, if you will, that we're seeing in the Democrats who constantly, I mean, I use the example of the Senate right now. The Senate, which has a Democratic dominance, instead of operating the way the Republicans do in the House, is creating these bipartisan commissions to come up with legislation. Hey, these guys don't play fair. This is not a game. It's time to get hardcore and to force issues based on vote counting and nothing else.
Well, it looks like the centrist and the of both parties are joining together to form a party to avoid anything like what happened when Ralph Nader got enough attention to try to come into the debates, which of course he was forced by both parties to not be able to participate in. They used their own henchmen, our police forces, to do it, to keep him out of there.
Go ahead.
I didn't mean to cut you off. I just wanted to get you to wrap things up. But listen, thank you very much for the call. I want to make a couple follow up on a couple of your points. Joe, you mentioned that looking at the way the Senate runs now, I'd say an even better example is how the Senate ran during the first 2 years of Obama's presidency when there was a large Democratic majority. Yet because the Republicans decided that all of a sudden you needed 60 votes to pass anything in the Senate, the Democrats were able to go throw up their hands and say, oh, we can't get to 60 votes, which was a fig leaf for them. It allowed them to safely voice their opposition to what the Republicans were doing without ever actually being forced to challenge the prerogatives of the donor class. It was a way out for them, and it worked pretty admirably. And secondly, about holding Obama to account, I honestly feel he doesn't feel like he needs to be held to account. There isn't anybody who can hold him to account. When 2012 comes around, progressives will face the same old dilemma. Do I vote for a truly progressive candidate, or do I let Sarah Palin into the White House? It's the same old song.
I think it's going to be the comb-over guy.
The comb-over guy? Trump?
Trump.
Right.
I would love to see Trump as president. I think it's wonderful irony.
You're again faced with the lesser of two evils, or the evil of two lessers, however you want to put it. It's the same old progressive dilemma. And until we make a fundamental change, and as the caller suggested, a change to the mechanics of our electoral process could work.
231-8187.
We got to take care of some biz. Coming up this morning on KBOO at 9, Alternative Radio features journalist Robert Fisk and Araxi Barsamian, mother of Alternative Radio producer David Barsamian, speaking on the Armenian Holocaust. At 10,
it here, never took place.
That's what the Turks say. At 10, here, Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, investigative reporter Dar Jamail talks about how the BP oil disaster will linger for decades. And journalist John Gibler talks about To Die in Mexico, his new book that tells behind-the-scenes stories that address the causes and consequences of Mexico's multi-billion-dollar drug trafficking business. At 11 on Stage and Studio, host Emay Roberts talks with Oregon author Jane Kirkpatrick. Her latest book is The Daughter's Walk, which is based on the true story of a mother and daughter in 1896 who both walked from Spokane, Washington to New York City to save the family farm. And at 11 on Art Focus, painter April Waters talks about She Rose, her exhibit of larger-than-life portraits of women activists currently at Portland Artists Repertory Theater. Thank you, KBOO members, for your support. If you're not a KBOO member, you can become one now by going to kboo.fm and clicking on the tip jar. You can also find archived versions of this show and virtually every other show on this fantastic community-supported radio station.
All right, let's get back to the topic. We're talking, if you're just tuning in, we're talking about the budget, and we're talking about the fact that there are two stark, even with Obama, two stark different views of how American governance should take place in terms of taking care of people.
You make a good point. Even with Obama, there's still a stark difference in what's being proposed. A lot of you call up time and again and say there's no difference between the two major parties. That's true to a point, but when lines come to be drawn, there are differences remaining. Obama is not talking about gutting Medicare. Obama is not talking about gutting Social Security. Obama is not talking about giving still more tax breaks to the very wealthiest Americans. He is not talking about any of these things. In fact, he is defending an alternate point of view. The proof, though, will be in whether or not he actually lives up to what he says.
I thought the proof would be in the pudding.
That's true, but pudding's kind of gone out of fashion.
That was a long pause there. 231-8187.
Stephen, good morning.
Yeah, good morning. You know, I think we need somehow to be able to reach the public and tell them the things that the Democratic Party should have been telling them for the past 2 years and has not.
For example,
in 2009... they opposed Obama's health care. One of the things they did, among their scare tactics, was to say that this was going to cut back on Medicare because I'm sure you remember this.
All right, hands off my Medicare.
Yeah, hands off.
Government hands off my Medicare.
Yeah, the government keep its hands off my Medicare. And the only factual basis for this is that the Obama's program involved transferring some money from the Medicare budget to another part of the health care plan. In other words, this was not being taken out of people's health care, but just shifted from one pocket to another. But the right came in there and said, look, he's cutting this money out of Medicare. He's going to take away your Medicare. Now, less than 2 years later, they're coming along and saying we can't afford Medicare. Now, somebody needs to start pointing this stuff out, because people will remember that if you remind them. This entire budget thing, this is the total wrong approach. Even what Obama is doing is not actually going to deal effectively with the problem in any kind of a constructive way. There is a way to do this, and it has been discussed. It's been discussed by Kuttner. It's been discussed by Stiglitz. And you can go online and find it. They outline a way of bringing the debt back into a reasonable arena, and it does not involve austerity programs, which is exactly what you don't want in a recession.
But it does involve taxing the rich.
It involves taxing the rich.
Not outrageous taxes, I might add.
Yeah, that's right. Modest. Modest taxes. If we had a very modest sales tax on Wall Street securities, it would bring in tons of money.
Well, how about a truly progressive income tax?
A progressive income tax, exactly. Cut out all of those loopholes that are designed particularly for the rich.
Well, you know what I always say: the rich get richer, and the poor get children.
Yeah, well, of course, that's it's been that way forever. But we have had periods in the past when there was some balance in this sort of thing, and we don't have it now. And the Democrats have absolutely failed. They've failed to come up with a really convincing, constructive response to all of this business about the deficit and debt.
No, I think you're right. And I think that really the focus has to be on the fact that running elections takes money, and money is in the hands of the moneyed class.
Yes, and it takes money largely because of television.
Indeed,
this is a
yes.
case of the deformation of society by technology. And anything that we try to do now is going to be frustrated by the Supreme Court. So we've got to think of some way of getting this information and position papers, reminding people to reach the public and expose some of this stuff. And what's going on now is really very clever, because we come to a place where Obama makes a sort of halfway strong response to this. We've got to cut everything, we can't afford any social programs. And what happens? Standard & Poor's comes out with this warning that if something isn't done really fast, we're going to cut the credit rating of the United States government.
I disagree that was in reaction to Obama's position. I think that was a reaction to Republican threats to not raise the country's debt ceiling, which would result in us defaulting on our debt obligations for the first time in our history. That's what scared the market, and that's what led Standard & Poor's to give that warning.
I think both of you are right, actually. I think that it's both a political manipulation against social democratic activity and a warning about what would happen if you had this collision course leading to failure to cover the national debt.
Yeah, well, I'm sure that they were scared about that, and they probably wanted the right wing to back off on that. But, you know, it wasn't actually issued at the time when that seemed to be a live option.
That's an interesting point.
Thank you very much for the call. Appreciate your points.
Okay, thank you.
The caller mentioned money. That is the heart of the problem, and it's specifically money that needs to be spent on television in order to win elections. That's very much the problem. And in the wake of that Citizens United Supreme Court decision last year, it looms all the larger. This decision, as Joe alluded to earlier, says that corporate entities, or anyone for that matter, can spend as much money as they want in support of anybody's candidacy, and they don't even need to reveal who they are.
Well, you could spend millions. You could spend millions.
I could if I had millions to spend.
Well, whose fault is that?
I don't know. But then when you couple that with the recent assault on labor unions and the right of workers to organize, collectively bargain, and so on, in today's modern political economy, the only counterweight of any significance to corporate money is union money. And if unions are busted, the Democratic Party loses its principal funding base. And so the Democrats, I predict, in order to continue to compete on television, to run viable campaigns, they will have to turn more and more to corporate money, which will drive the discourse even farther to the right than it already is.
Well, you've cheered me up,
This
Abe.
Is all of a piece, Joe. This is all of a piece. That Supreme Court decision and the effort to knock out unions. Not only because Republicans are ideologically opposed to workers organizing, but because they realize if they bust unions, then the Democrats lose their ability to compete.
503-231-8187.
Maria.
Yes.
You're on the air.
All right. I'm calling to say that there is a difference between both parties, and the difference is that one party exists to drive the nation further right, and the other party exists to maintain the plateau. That's my observation after Obama.
That's not a bad observation.
No, not at all.
Is that it?
Well, that's almost it. The other thing is that I would like to encourage people to videotape themselves burning the campaign, the little campaign things we all get in the mail to give him more money for the next election, and texting it.
You want to scare him? You want to scare Obama to the left, huh?
I want to just let him know. There's no scaring anyone anywhere. I'm not in denial about that at all.
Okay.
Yeah, that's it.
Thank you for the call.
Bye.
I don't know. Fire.
Who's next, Steve? Fire? Fire's kind of scary. Tom, good morning.
Hi, guys. I'm kind of with Maria there. I definitely think that as it keeps being apologizing for the Democratic Party being spineless and Obama being a mediator, I think if you really look at these things, they do have a will to power. They like to stay in power. Obama's not spineless. Most of the people that ran aren't spineless. You can't run for president of the United States and be spineless and not be able to hold your ground. You know, especially as an African American and the first one to win. Mm-hmm. So I think the thing that'll work is people need to get a little bit more educated. Our education system doesn't do a lot for reason and logic, but when people can see through these things as they're presented to them, I mean, it was pretty early on as Obama said he'd take just the government funding for finances of his campaign if McCain would, and then he realized he's going to make more money. McCain said, "Yeah, I want to take the government money." He changed his mind right there. The guy showed pretty early on, you know, that he would do what it takes to be in power. I don't think that most of these people in power in our government actually care about us. And the ones that are presented to us definitely don't. You know, we don't hear about the People's Caucus, and we don't hear about the budget that they have. That is more along the right lines, I would say, but it still doesn't tax people enough. You know, 49% for the super wealthy. So I think it's get the money out, but also it's education. We have to really teach people and kids and people to think and reason and logic things out.
Well said, sir.
All right.
Well, thank you very much.
Hey, thanks for the call. 503-231-8187. We're also taking emails, joeandabe@yahoo.com. Who's up? Barry.
Yeah. Hi, I'm having a little difficulty with the phone, but I guess you're hearing me.
I'm
hearing you. Clear.
Yeah, I'm sorry that I didn't get on earlier because this Lyndon Johnson, he worked against President Kennedy, and he extended the war. President Kennedy, in a book by Paul W. Sawyer, a Unitarian minister, he wrote about his years in social justice, and he wrote about President Kennedy, his October 11th. Executive order that all advisors are to be out of Vietnam, I guess, the next year, because this war in Vietnam, this war was costing a lot of money. It's very burdensome. We don't want to have any more part of it. And then President Johnson, Lyndon B. Johnson, got in, and he extended the war against the very last executive order of President Kennedy. And what you want to do is talk more about President Kennedy. President Kennedy. Listen to President Kennedy. But these guys that sort of usurped the war machine, that you don't want to do that. Can you understand?
Well, I understand what you're saying, but I think that Kennedy was a cold warrior and definitely saw the world in terms of two camps. He went ahead and agreed to the planning for the Bay of Pigs and so on. I don't know. I think that the whole of the politics of the United States from the end of World War II to now really has a similarity in assumption of the us and them kind of analysis.
Uh-huh. But more of an inclusion in President Kennedy. What can we do for our government? Not our government can do for us. Yet our government is actually doing to us.
I think we need to leave it at that on that topic, because you know what? Most of our audience wasn't even alive when President Kennedy died.
Yeah, still, we don't want to forget any of the past, like the...
Oh, no, you're right. Right? I'm not disagreeing with you there.
That's kind of what I wanted to say.
Yeah.
Okay?
I appreciate it.
Hey, thanks very much for the call.
You're welcome. Thank
you. Let's see if we can get a few more in here before the end. Excuse me, who? Beth, good morning.
Yeah, good morning. I couldn't hear anything the previous caller was saying. It was I just couldn't hear anything.
Well, you're coming through loud and clear.
So I don't know what I'm following. But I called mainly because of the when Reagan busted the air control tower folks, he busted that union.
Mm-hmm.
That was just, I was crushed. I could not believe he would take a union and just, break it up and just say, we're not, no more. But since then, it's, this is an everyday thing. I mean, you don't turn on the TV and hear the labor report. You hear the business report. You're not going to have an hour of labor news.
That's true. Because
labor unions aren't there anymore.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing to give news on. When I follow up on the control tower folks, I heard this morning on the news, I think it was on the news, that the guy in charge of making the changes so these poor people who have to stay up all night and bring in all these planes and make sure they don't run into each other in the air while they're landing are not to nap. He said absolutely he would not pay money for anyone to nap. And there's like one person up there in the tower. There's one person. And all the other countries in the world have at least two, and they have it set up so that it rotates, and they say they have sleep times.
Well, yeah, you're right. But the whole...
I don't want to be in an airplane coming into an airport where the guy's been up 14 hours, and, some rich guy decided that he wasn't going to pay for this guy to take a nap. And or even have a backup guy.
Seems you should err on the side of safety rather than...
This is not our topic today, but it's worse than that. The airplanes that they made were supposed to last X number of hours, and they're not. They're falling apart.
That's right.
Well, Reagan did it to cut budgets. I mean, he closed the mental hospital in California when he was governor. I mean, everything's about making, cutting jobs, so that you can make more money because you're rich and you're not rich enough.
That's right. Hey, listen, thank you very much for the call. I think we need to wrap it up.
We do?
We do.
We do.
It's Steve saying we got to end at 8:58, and it's nearly 8:58.
Okay, well, gee, I there's so much more to do, man.
I know, man.
Well, hey there, what are you going to do?
Thanks, everyone, for your phone calls, and we'll be back at you next week.
We will. And you keep listening to KBOO because it's the only game in town.